Hey, and welcome to episode 7 of the Hey You Guys podcast with me, Liam Pritchard, and Rob Westgates.
How you doing, mate?
Feel free to say hey. Oh, there we go. There we go. This is the bit we always mess up at the start. Well, anyway, this week we're doing the 1989 Joe Dante classic, The Burbs. I say classic, but it's one of those films. I'm not sure if everybody sees it the same way. But before we get into the questions, I've got to get this out of the way. My brother last week was very upset because obviously I mentioned at the end of the episode what's the next movie we're doing. And it was actually his suggestion to do The Burbs. And I didn't give him a shout out. So he calls me up to like bust my chops about it. But mainly he was a little upset that I may have suggested that he suffered from mental retardation because my mum smoked when he was being born. So he wasn't happy about that at all. Like, he phones me up and he's like, so what's up with saying I'm mentally retarded? Because mum smoked when she was pregnant. And you keep mentioning how tall you are. And I'm like, dude, I mentioned how tall I am. I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing. I'm not sure if everybody wants to be 6'7". And just out of the blue then, he's like, you do realize you don't see any old people above 6'5", right? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, they all die. I'm like, so you're phoning me up to moan about the fact that I suggested in a comedic manner that you might be mentally retarded to tell me that I'm essentially in the death zone. Because I was like, well, what about Clint Eastwood? He's like 100 years old. He's tall. He's like, oh, no, he's 6'4". You're above 6'5". So anything above 6'5", you basically phoned me to say your number's up. You know, well, you haven't got long left because you're that tall. Like, nobody gets old if they're 6'7".
Well, two things on that. First of all, I got to thank your brother then because I'm 6'4", so I'm good.
Oh, you're fine. You're going to live to be 100. You're in the Clint Eastwood zone, whereas I am clearly in the death zone.
So we're not going to talk about the fact that probably cholesterol is clutching my heart, but because I'm 6'4", we're fine.
Life expectancy is linked completely to height as far as my brother's concerned.
So. You got a point.
Fantastic. Well, anyway, thanks, John. So yeah, it was his idea to suggest that The Burbs, and I'm glad he did, because The Burbs I actually watched like a month ago because I love The Burbs, and it showed up on Amazon, and I was more than happy to watch this film again. Like, it is it's aged so well. It is the I would say it's the perfect movie for our times, actually, because, you know, you think about it, it's a movie set entirely in this like tiny little suburb. It's all on this one set on Mayfield Street, isn't it?
Yeah,
Mayfield Street. And it's like, you think now, everybody's stuck inside, everyone's stuck in their own little neighborhoods, and you just become obsessed with the people around you, you know? And the fact that when I watch the film, I think of it as almost as being like The Goonies for grown-ups. And instead of like a sense of adventure, it replaces adventure with like paranoia, suburban paranoia. Yeah.
The paranoia and stuff does dig in, but it also feels like they're making silly choices. And it's just, you just wonder, these choices, and we'll get into the choices and everything like that. I was never really into this as a kid. I watched it, I loved it, but it was never one that I'd always go back to. But if it was on TV, I'd tape it, as we used to have to do, and watch it again. But I watched it last night, and it's been a while since I've watched this, a long time. And again, I still think it's a great film, but what's the point of this film?
I mean, I'm not 100% sure. The thing is, I'm not sure it needs to have a point, because the one thing I was talking to my friend about it, and the word that kept coming up when we spoke about it, was just how charming it is. It's just this, for me, it's like the perfect 4 out of 5 film. It's like, it doesn't strive to be a 5-star film. It just nails that 4-star. And not only that,
we already know Liam's rating.
Yeah, here we go. Bit of a spoiler alert there. But it's like, to me, it's the quintessential 80s movie. It ticks all the boxes. It's got like the great cast. It's got like the exaggerated, you know, versions of people you know. It's super charming. It's got this amazing set. It's got that odd sense of positivity, despite the fact that it's, you know, a horror comedy, I suppose. It's just, you know, for me, like you say, I'm not sure if it does have a point, but it's almost like, despite the fact, again, it does have horror elements, the whole film to me feels like a warm hug. Like, I could just happily have it on the background all day.
I don't even think it has horror elements. It's just... I don't know. It's all misunderstandings from my point of view about these lazy people, these slobs that move next door. And the quintessential laziness, I'm going to drive my rubbish to the curbside. That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
It seems like they threw in, and I know I'm jumping straight to the end. And I know you get to the end of the film, and then all of a sudden they just go, oh, by the way, yeah. They are murderers. Why are they murderers? Like, has anyone ever been looking for them? They just decided to kill the old people, the Knapps, who lived in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there was a lot of bones in the back of that car.
There were a lot of bones.
They never explained why they were killing people. Like, what the motive. It was literally just, I think these guys are bad. Oh, wait, no, they're good. Oh, no, wait, they are bad. And then it was the calamity of errors to get to that point. It was...
The whole film has that kind of vibe where you're just like you say, in terms of what's the point, is there a message to this film? You kind of, you're going through it and you're like, oh, is it the idea that, you know, in Suburbia, you know, because it comes back to the idea, what do you think of this film? Do you think of it as a horror comedy or do you think of it as a satire? But it doesn't really lean onto either one. Again, this whole idea that it's a bit nebulous, probably why it didn't go down well with critics at the time, why it wasn't a massive hit. Because you don't know what kind of film it is. And even at the end of it, it's like, wait, are we, you know, up until literally, what, 3 minutes from the end, you almost get the idea that the message is like, oh, you know, don't distrust, you know, your foreign neighbors, you know, kind of, it's playing into this idea of xenophobia that it's like, oh, just because they're foreign and they're a bit different, you all kind of get into your little gangs and stuff and you all assume they're murderers. But then in the last 3 minutes, it turns out they are fucking murderers. So it's like, I don't know what the message is. And then Art has that great speech at the end, which I'm not sure if it makes any sense, where it's like, so I think the message to psychos, fanatics, murderers, nutcases all over the world is don't mess with suburbanites because, frankly, we're not going to take it anymore, you know? We're not going to be content to look after our lawns and wax our cars, paint our houses. We're going to go out and get them. Don, we're going to get them. And I listen to that speech at the end. I'm like, wait, so is this a movie about not fucking with suburbanites?
Yeah. Is this the beginning of The Purge? Like, the suburbanites have just decided, right, we're just going to go out and we're just going to, like, just take everybody else.
Honestly, the message I take from it is that if you have foreign neighbours, suspect them at every turn because they're probably murderers. that's what I could...
Well, that's quintessential 80s, isn't it? That's the...
It really is, yeah. That's Reagan-era politics right there.
If we go back to the very beginning, that Google Maps opening before Google Maps starts.
It's unbelievable.
Fantastic opening. Well, that animation.
Well, one of the things, we'll lean into it now, just because we've only got a few, because one of the things I sent this week, I just sent out a kind of, you know, does anybody have any questions this week, you know, that we can answer on the podcast? And there are a few. So before we get to that, there's actually... I forgot to put down their name, but they mentioned, like, have you seen the alternate ending? And it just plays into what we were saying then about, like, the tone of the thought. Have you actually seen the alternate ending of this film?
I literally watched it just before we logged on. And I'll just say that was John Truman.
Oh, John Truman. Thank you, John Truman, for the question. So John Truman, like, he asked, like, you know, have you seen the alternate ending? We both have now. And what do we think of it? Well, one of the things, if you go back and watch it, it does give the end, the whole film, a more satirical bent. I actually think, don't get me wrong, I prefer the actual ending, but tonally, the ending of the alternate ending makes more sense on a tonal level, because you have the whole bit about the guy saying, yeah, I kill all these people, but he has this moan about the fact that everybody's so suspicious of them. And it kind of plays up on both sides. It's like, yeah, they're murderers, but, you know, you didn't give them a chance in the first place. And it's also got this, like, quite the way everybody goes into their houses, an implied sex scene with Bruce Dern and his wife, which is a bit weird, but we'll get to that.
The old soldier's debrief, as it were.
Yeah, totally. So he's going to go in and get his end away. And then it's just kind of Art left on his own. And it's almost a bit of a melancholy ending. And I actually really like the use of music. They cut to the Won't You Be My Neighbor from...
Mr. Rogers.
From Mr. Rogers, the TV show. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, that whole ending, it makes more sense tonally, but it's not as fun. And that is the thing with this film. I think it kind of... It leans into the, you know, don't worry so much about the message. Let's just have a good time. And that's why I think it's so fun.
I think the original ending, not the the theatrical ending, as it were, that fits more with the tone of the film as they've gone through. And I know I've already questioned, like, the point of the film, the ride that we're on to get to the last 3 minutes. If you look at the alternate ending and they turn around and, like, they, like you said, they make that comment about nobody trusting anyone or anything, and nobody asks questions in LA.
And, that was a great line.
And it kind of shifts the tone a little bit. So I think although it's nice to see what the alternate ending, I think the original ending is the one to stick with.
No, I agree. I think the alternate ending works better thematically, but the, like you said, the theatrical ending works more tonally, and I prefer to keep with the tone, because the tone of the movie, as strange as it is something that I love. And that brings me back, so we're jumping back to what you just said, because Adam Haversidney, or Puddin as I call him, he asked us about the opening shot, which you're about to mention, that fantastic opening shot where it starts with the Universal logo, yeah, zooms into the planet, down into the United States and onto the street. Do you actually know how they did that?
I know it was an animation. That's as far as I can get.
Well, I couldn't find how they did it anywhere. All I could think was that the star is, like you say, an animation, like a model of, you know, the Universal thing. So it zooms into that, and then it's a collection of matte paintings, which they cut between, which they're constantly zooming into. So each matte painting, they're zooming into that matte painting, then it cuts to another matte painting, which is more detailed, it zooms into that, until eventually you get into the miniature set, which it clearly is at the end, and then it kind of zooms in and you actually see Tom Hanks. So I think it's a clever combination of miniature animations and matte paintings. That's not factual, but you know, Adam asked us to answer that question, so that's the best I can do. But whatever the case, the fact that it's 1989, it looks unbelievable. Yeah.
And aside from starting off in space, is it the entire film then is that street?
The whole film. Doesn't move it's anywhere all else. One set. It's
literally that one set. And once again, feeling like Beetlejuice's model village.
100%. That is exactly.
And you have that feeling of it. And I know we'll probably jump into facts and things, and there's not many facts for this that I could find, but the one being that this street was, because it's on the Universal backlot, I believe.
Yeah, it is.
And it was used a lot in other things, like I think Desperate Housewives was filmed on there.
That was the most prominent one, yeah. That street was used, and it's still there, I think, the whole thing.
I believe
thing.
So. I think the only house that hasn't changed, they said, was Walter's at the end. I think every other thing has had a bit of a change to it, but...
fair enough.
Yeah.
But it's one of those ones, like... It's something that keeps popping up in these 80s films. I mean, they obviously happen in Monster Squad. It's the brilliant use of sets. Like, it feels a bit like a set, but it adds to that sense of magic that is running through the film.
Yeah.
And that sense of magic is established, you know, that amazing opening shot, which supposedly, I'm not sure if this is a rumor, inspired Google Earth. Like, they're like, we want to be able to do that. So I want to believe that's true, that the birds inspired Google Earth. But... It kind of leans to the fact that there's no fat on this movie. There's another one of those films like Predator where you just feel like every scene is essential. It's like it zooms in and you just get a shot of Tom Hanks. You have all the neighbors. You immediately get this idea for these unique characters, the fact that everybody's nosy, everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
Straight away, you see the house, like all these pristine houses. You see this one house, which isn't quite right. It kind of immediately you get the characters, you get the tone, you get a feel for the film all in the first opening minutes.
Yeah.
And then it's like straight into it. And like the film is actually really, like, I think it's an hour and 40 or something, but it's super pacey, this film. Super pacey.
It moves along because it's meant to be over the course of a week for his vacation, isn't it? Monday to Friday. And I'm not sure that he's on vacation. I'm still under the thing. He's fired.
I think so too, because even at the end, he's like, I'm just taking another vacation.
I'm going to go
it's
again,
just
yeah.
like, yeah, really? Are you,
I'm pretty sure he's got fired from his job. But
well, there's some questions here.
As you go, sorry?
No, sorry, carry on.
As you go into the beginning, everything you said then, introducing the neighbours, they all know each other, everything like that. The one thing that I got out of that was Paperboy's a bit of a dick, isn't he?
The Paperboy is an absolute dick. just throws it out.
If I was a Paperboy back then, and you were doing it, because obviously when we were Paperboy here, you got to actually post it through the letterbox. But they're just like allowed to chuck them at the... at the house. I would probably be doing the same thing, just hurling it wherever I could. Like.
See, I never thought of it before, but now that you mention it, I'm like, could it potentially be a subtle nod to the arcade and NES classic Paperboy? Because most of Paperboy, the video game, is set on a street which looks just like the set of the movie. And the whole thing is you throwing papers through windows at people, at dogs. So maybe it was just a subtle like nod to the Paperboy being an absolute bellend.
Or this random live-action version of...
Just a brief reenaction of Paperboy. Yeah. I'm not sure if that works as a sentence. But we'll get to the fact that, the Paperboy was a dick, but I've got a question about whether Ray Peterson is actually a bit of a bellend as well. But we'll get to that in a minute after we've done the questions.
See, so I'm the other one, because I'm the neighbour. I can't remember his name right now.
I think they're all dicks.
Oh, they are.
But I think the whole idea is that Tom Hanks is supposed to be, you know, he always plays the everyman. And this is arguably his most everyman character kind of thing.
Yeah.
But as the film goes on, the more and more I'm like, I think he might be a bit of a dick. But anyway, like, we got two more questions. So Gareth Peterson or Banks, one of my best friends. I say one of my best friends because Pudding will be listening to this as well, and they'll get very upset if I pick sides. So, you know, one of my best friends. He asks, so Bruce Dern's wife in the movie, it's like, how did he, his words specifically, how did he bag such a hot wife? Because Bruce Dern has, he looks about 100 in this film.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's still going, like, Bruce Dern must be like 160 years old now. It's ridiculous. But yeah, his wife is, it's pretty hot by comparison. I don't know.
Well, all I can think is he is like the way Corey Feldman is just staring at it and going, no tan lines today.
Yeah. And he's just like, dude, that guy's a meatball. I think maybe just because he has the best lines. Like Bruce Dern's character, what the hell's his name? Mark Runsfield. I mean, some of my favorite lines in the film, Pinocchio, where do you think you're going? Oh no, Pinocchio, where are you going? Like right at the end, I love that line. when they're having, I think maybe she likes him just because he's the most confrontational. Like when they go round for the sardine and pretzels. And he's being an asshole. Like the bit when he just pulls the wallpaper up from the wall, that drives me up. Like it drives me crazy. I'm like, why would you do that to someone? You asshole.
When he's constantly turning the painting over, like
he's such an asshole. And it's just like how everyone else is trying to be quite subtle, and he just gets everyone's girl. What you got in the cellar here, Klopak?
But like, she's got to be watching him as well, thinking, have I really married a guy that's now playing Ding Dong Ditch?
That is one of the things about this film is. Again, it plays into that whole idea that it's the Goonies for grown-ups because they are just a bunch of kids. I mean, they're a bunch, like, so many of the actions, like, you know, the scene when they're, like you say, ding-dong-dish, they're daring each other to ring the doorbell of the haunted house. It's like when you grew up, like, everybody had, like, a house which they thought was haunted. It just kind of plays up on that idea. Like, that idea, you go, oh, I'm not ringing on that doorbell. I reckon that house is haunted. And it's just them being grown-ups but still doing it. And it's one of the reasons I love this film and so many films like it is that idea that you can relate to characters. And, you know, so much of the movie rests on that relationship between Tom Hanks and Art.
Yeah.
What's his name? What the hell's his name? Ray's character.
It's Peter.
Rick DeCommon from Die Hard. He was in it last week. I don't know why he's not in more stuff. He's fucking awesome in everything I see him in. But he's like essential. He's like the foil to, well, what is initially at least Tom Hanks' straight man. But it's like, you need a friend like that. It's like, well, funny enough, somebody already mentioned Banks, one of my best friends. He was that kid growing up. Like, you know, like you think, oh, like I don't believe in any of this nonsense. He was the kid in primary school who always believed in the Green Lady. And I remember like once he was like pointing up at the school tower and he had all these kids around him and he's telling them the story of the Green Lady. Like he's a fucking specialist on the subject. Yeah. And he was like the one who got us all into the toilet to do like turn around, touch the ground, black magic. You know, the kind of kids equivalent of saying Candyman five times.
Yeah.
Like, you need that person who's willing to take you on that journey. So you're like, oh, yeah, this is dumb. I don't believe it. But you kind of go along with it because you almost want to believe it. And I think that is the thing with these guys. It's like, because their lives are relatively boring, relatively mundane, it's like, as much as they kind of fight against Art being a buffoon, they're like, oh, but I want to believe it. I want to believe it's haunted. I want to believe something's going on because it'll make my life more exciting. Everybody on the street does. They want to turn it into their own little personal soap opera.
It felt like Art was just let off the lead. Like his wife's gone away wherever she's gone, and he's just he's just free to make all his fantasies come true. Like, and his fantasy for some reason is screw with the neighbors.
Well, I just love the fact that his wife's gone away, so the first thing he does is grab a gun and decide to shoot crows. He
and
almost kills Ray immediately.
Also, it looked like it was just like some weird pump action rifle that he had, like maybe even an air rifle. Why did it sound like an automatic weapon?
Yeah. I don't know. I assumed it was an air rifle, but then I heard the sound. I'm like, I think that might just be a rifle. I think that would have legitimately killed Ray if it hit him in the head.
And I love that because I had that written down where like you say, he nearly shot, like killed him. And he just turned around and went, oh, hi, Ray.
How's it going? And then he goes into his house, and I've got to give it to him because you always think it's like how many takes do they actually like?
Yeah.
It's one of those things like if you've never noticed it before, when you watch movies and you see people eat, one of the things you'll notice is that they often just play with their food because they often like they're doing like 5, 10, 15 takes, whatever. So they don't want to keep eating this fucking food, so they just play with the food. They never actually eat it. He goes in the kitchen. He's cane in the ribs. He eats that whole bit of French toast covered in maple syrup. I love the fact that he goes into the fridge and brings out a pineapple. He's just like, whatever he gets fucking hands on, he just starts
eating it. Even when they go to Walter's house, and this guy may be dead, but we're just going to go through his fridge and
just tatting his food.
We've gone on to Ray. You said you have one more question.
Sorry, I got carried away. So this is from Stuart Dean, who asked, does Ricky Butler, Corey Feldman, does he live alone? Do we know about his parents? What's going on with him?
So there was a brief little mention when he said his parents are coming back Thursday.
Oh, okay. I couldn't remember that.
When he's got the girl over for the first time, the first night that Ray and Art are going to try and sneak to the house.
Yeah.
Got his girlfriend over, and he said, oh, my parents, I think it was him or her, but my parents will be back Thursday. So, because he's meant to leave the house before they come home.
Yeah. So he's fine. His parents are coming back. No problems there. How do we feel? Same again from Stuart. How do we feel about the Ferris Bueller moment at the end when, just out of the fucking blue, he decides to have a kind of break the fourth wall and speak to the audience?
It kind of he knows you're watching, kind of thing. So the spectator. So I don't think it takes you out as much as it should.
I think it's great. I think it, like, I honestly, I didn't even think about it until he asked the question. Like, it was only when he said it, I was like, yeah, he totally breaks the fourth wall. To me, it felt quite natural. I just went with it. I was just like, yeah, of course he's, but it was only when he mentioned it. I was like, it doesn't happen in any other part of the film.
No,
and it's just all of a sudden he's talking to the, yeah, it's quite bizarre. But so we haven't really got an answer, but I think it works. And
I just sat there, every time he came on the screen, I just sat there thinking, he's got gorgeous hair.
Oh, he does have great hair.
Like, his hair just flowing through the wind. As I'm rubbing my bald head at the moment, his hair's just flowing in the wind and everything. And
well, that leads into the whole idea that this film feels absolutely timeless to me. And one of the things, I mean, there are a few instances, like at one point he says, I'm going to listen to the ball game. So he's going to listen to the ball game on the radio. Yeah. Nobody's fucking doing that anymore. But for the most part, because you don't see too many cars, the houses still all look great. You know, they are like legitimately that picture perfect white picket fence version of US suburbia.
Yeah.
And the way people dress, like Corey Feldman's character for the most part looks pretty cool. Like, he's got the hair, he's wearing the Ray-Bans. The only questionable choice is maybe the tie-dye t-shirt with the leather jacket with all the fucking studs on it.
But you know, he borrowed that from Michael Jackson, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely borrowed that from Michael Jackson. But like Ray Peterson, like, when he comes out, he's wearing like deck shoes, like fitted shorts, like a cool top. I'm like, you could wear that today and it would look absolutely fine. And Art is wearing like a super awesome pair of like checked Vans trainers. And I'm just like, these guys, like, they could dress like that today and nobody would mind it.
Why is Art constantly wearing what looks like boxer shorts?
I have no idea. Like, I have no idea.
Those shorts, they're just, to me, they're boxer shorts. They are literally what
they do look like boxer shorts. They totally do.
Yeah, and they're your normal shorts or something. It's like he's just, again, my wife's away, I'm going to dress how I want, and I'm just going to walk up the street in my boxer shorts.
I'm just going to do this all week. I love the fact when he shows up at one point when they try and trick Ray's wife, Carrie Fisher, and he shows up just briefly wearing like head-to-toe golf gear, the most like ridiculously over the top golf gear just to sell that one moment. I'm pretty sure it changes out of it immediately. It's a bit much for my taste, I can see why he might be committed to the cause.
When they start trying to invest, like the three of them decide that we're going to investigate the Klochek's, the Klochek's,
Klochek's. You got me confused then. If you say it wrong enough, eventually I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck.
When we're going to start investigating the Klochek's. And they all hide behind the bush. And Soldier Boy, Bruce Dern, pulls out the infrared scope.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And he says, snipers use this in the bush or wherever he says. I'm saying, if a sniper used that, you would clearly see him anyway, because that thing is fucking massive.
I wonder sometimes is how legitimate his army credentials actually are. You know, like, again, he acts all confrontational, but like he's actually pretty sheepish when things are about to go down. Yeah. So I wonder if he's one of these guys who didn't actually serve, or maybe he just kind of served in the reserves or something like that and just really
The ROTC, I think it was, or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something ridiculous. But that, again, the thing with this film, and it's one of the things I actually love, is that there's never actually really any sense of threat. Like, everything about it, it's always the right side of, like, Well, they don't even want to call the cops. Like, everything, again, feels almost like quite childish. This idea that it could actually happen to you. Like, you can imagine you and your friends be like, ah, they're a little bit suspicious. And it just kind of obviously towards the end gets out of hand.
Yeah.
But it's basically just a bunch of idiot guys daring each other. And so until it gets out of hand and you're like, well, we're in too deep now, essentially.
And I think we've all done it. You've talked to your neighbor about the other neighbors. Do you know what I mean? You talk to your friends about these neighbors that you've got. And that's usually where it ends.
Yeah.
And this film is basically what would happen if you took it further.
Yeah, you know? Well, yeah, absolutely. Like, and the thing is, it all rests on Ray, doesn't it? It's like everyone else is like a little bit extreme, but he's like the leader of the group almost. And it almost feels like, oh, we need Ray on board. And this whole idea, like for most of the film, he's kind of being dragged along, but he's always got one foot in, one foot out. And it's just that one moment at the end, obviously, when they go around to meet them and the dog attacks him, that he finally breaks and he's like, I'm all in. And as soon as he's all in, things start moving really quickly. And it's, you know, it kind of leans into this whole idea that, it's like, is his character actually nice? Because, like, I don't know, like, he's super argumentative with his wife. He appears to be lazy. He might be unemployed, as you say. Mm. He's quite cowardly at times. He's a bit of a psycho. But then equally, he's like, he's pushed over the edge really easily to just do absolutely outrageous things.
Yeah, he's talked into it too easy.
Yeah, like the more I watch him, I'm like, I think he might be a dick, Ray Peterson. I'll tell you one thing for sure. He drinks juice like an absolute fucking asshole. The way he drinks juice drives me up the wall.
Yeah, I just think when he sat on that balcony, and the way he's drinking that juice was...
Noise, everything about it. Mm. But then he totally makes up for it almost immediately because nobody crushes beer cans like Ray Peterson. The way he kind of squeezes, like, I feel his anger so much.
He turned around and said,
motherfucker.
When she turned around and said, do you feel better now? He's like, yeah, I kind of do. Like,
he's totally an asshole. And I love it. It's just like he's sitting on the fence and that amazing scene with him and Walter where they're having the chat and he just keeps throwing the bone back to the dog. He's like, Ray, Ray, you know what this is? What do you think this came from? A chicken?
Yeah.
Ray,
this is
Walter.
I love the camera work at that as well with the screen cameras going in and out. And it feels like an old 50s, 60s TV show kind of thing when you bad news halfway through or the misunderstanding halfway through. It's dun-dun-dun.
Yeah, that runs throughout the film, that whole kind of 50s aesthetic. And obviously that comes from the director, Joe Dante. And he's got a bit of a history with that. Like, he did that movie with John Goodman, Matinee.
Yeah.
There's Erie, Indiana. Again, it's got a really similar vibe to The Burbs, funny enough.
Mm.
And you see it in, like later on when the boot opens up and there's all the skeletons. And it's like the way the camera zooms in again. It's that really old-fashioned, like you say, 50s kind of movie aesthetic.
Yeah.
And one thing I'll say while I'm on the subject is, why does the 80s just have the best skeletons? Like, what is it about the 80s, man? Like, the skeletons in the boot are amazing. And I immediately think of the skeletons in Indiana Jones, the skeletons in the Goonies.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. If they moved to CG, like, skeletons have never been better. Never. Maybe it's because, like, the 80s...
They do look like they've actually dug them out of the ground themselves. Like,
they really do. Yeah. And I think it is because, like, we're talking, I guess, 89. And 89 was, like, the very height of physical effects. That's why I think so many of these films that we love have actually aged on a visual level so well. I think the problem comes more in the mid to late 90s, going into the 2000s, when they become more dependent upon CG. And obviously, it's improving as it goes. But you see stuff from even 10, 15 years ago, and it's pretty dodgy. Whereas this is like, what I compare it to is, you know, like with video games, it's the reason 16-bit era looks so good, because it's the height of pixel art.
Yeah.
And pixel art just never ages. But when you make that jump then to 3D, which I think of as being almost the equivalent of like CG in movies, you have this long period when it looks like dog shit. Not all of it, but a lot of it. You know, there are subtle uses. Some of the best uses, Jurassic Park, Terminator 2, and that's early doors. There's a lot of really rough CG in the 90s, but most of those films in like the mid to late 80s, where they're fucking puppet work, the you know, like the introduction when it zooms in, it's all kind of, you know, handmade stuff, but it just looks amazing and it holds up so well. they knew they couldn't do everything with CG, but they were just getting to that point where they're like, well, we could do the things which we could never do. So you think of Jurassic Park, you think of T2, it's this perfect combination of very limited CG and still in camera work. And it's only later when movies become completely dependent upon CG that it starts to fall to pieces. And even now, I hate films which kind of, you know, are overly reliant upon CG, especially for sets and stuff like that. I think it's horrible. So, and I think that is a big part of why the mid to late 80s in particular, like, always hold a special place in my heart. And I think age better than most eras of movies, for sure.
Changing the subject a little, I like the bit of foreshadowing they had in this as well. We haven't mentioned it yet, I don't think. Carrie Fisher, who was great in this, by the way.
She's amazing. Yeah. She's so good.
When she says, let's go and introduce ourselves before one of you falls off the roof and one of you is set on fire. And Art ends up falling off and going through the roof. And Ray blows himself up.
No, isn't it Bruce Dern falls off the roof?
Oh, sorry, Bruce Dern falls off the roof. Art falls through the shed thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, through the shed, has a whole bit when he's like... I love the fact that when he shocks himself, it always reminds me of, funny enough, a film we did a couple of weeks ago. It reminds me of Batman. Because when he holds his hands up and he's like, Ray, my nails are black. It looks just like the Joker's hands in 89 Batman. Looks exactly the same to me. It always reminds me of that. But she's great. And it's odd because... growing up, I never had the whole crush on Carrie Fisher thing from Star Wars.
No, I didn't.
Because I was too young. Like, I watched, Return of the Jedi, the whole bikini thing, before, you know, things kicked in, shall we say. I was like, you know, 5, 6 when I watched this thing. So I didn't have that kind of sexual attachment to the character, which a lot of other people did. And obviously, I grew up with the Burbs, no big deal. And this was maybe the first time going back and watching it again, because, you know, I'm, you know, knocking on 40 now, 39 years old. I was like, man, Carrie Fisher's hot. Like, there's something, like, she's like a total MILF in this one.
I texted you, didn't I? And I said that she's giving off some serious MILF vibes.
Absolutely.
And I didn't get it before. Like, I did not, again, with you, like, I was never into Carrie Fisher or anything like that. But aside from giving off those vibes, she's great in this as the long-suffering wife.
Yeah, she's great. She's like the perfect wife. Like, how she nails all those like little looks.
Yeah.
Like, I love the scene when, you know, like the wives like insist that they go around to the Clopex and introduce themselves. And he comes out and he's like sardine. And everyone's like, no. And then he gets to Tom Hanks, his character. And the way she just looks at him and gives like a little nod.
And it was one, you were thinking, it was one of those things where it was, you've started all this. I'm going to make you eat the sardine. And the noises. When he, because we're watching, and like a bit of a brag, but we're watching like on the surround sound and everything. So we've got the noises behind us of the oh my god, and it was so visceral. Like, it was
it's great. And it's not just that, it's like right from the very start, it's when he's picking up the sardine, they really lean into the slimy noise. When
he kept slipping off his finger, and why would you put it on a pretzel?
The thing is, it put me off pretzels and sardines for years because I just associated them with this film and like, oh, that's what monsters would give you to eat. Now I'm like, if somebody offered me a sardine and a pretzel, I'd be like, I'm going to eat that sardine and pretzel. That'd probably be quite nice. Salted and salted. Yeah, sure.
Like, I know they're trying to say like the Eastern European things and all, and they're trying to like build up on this that people don't have different, I want to say routines. I can't think of the actual word I'm going to say. Traditions. But a sardine and a pretzel, I don't think anywhere in the world a monster would put a sardine and a pretzel together. That's salt and salt.
Yeah, but do we find out where they're from? Like, again, Bruce Dern's character is like, oh, Klopek, what is that, Slavic? And the guy's like, no. It's just like, there's no answer to where they're from. They're just from wherever you put sardines.
I loved it.
But
the same thing.
Like, the audio, like you said, though, it's when he's sneezing. I can't even explain the noise.
Oh my
it's
god!
It's the weirdest fucking noise.
Did I write that down?
It's like when he blows his nose in the tissue, it makes a unique noise. And all it reminds me of, the closest I've come to that was, you know, like sometimes if you drink water, it goes up the wrong tube and feels like it's like behind your nose. I did that once with a bacon sandwich. And the bacon got stuck somewhere in my fucking head, and it was behind my nose.
You meant to swallow it, yeah?
Yeah, but it just went down. It went up the wrong pipe somehow. And I've got this bacon stuck behind my nose. It was the worst feeling fucking ever. And I remember I was blowing my nose and it was making that kind of noise.
Go back.
It felt so gross. And I was literally blowing bacon out of my fucking nose. It was so gross, dude.
Go back and listen to that scene again, right? And tell me it does not sound like trying to start a lawnmower.
It does a bit. It does. You can imagine pulling the cord.
Yeah, it exactly sounds like he's trying to start a lawnmower. It was such a great noise.
The only thing I thought at one point, it sounded a bit like an elephant because I was trying to figure out where they got the sound from. But now that you've said lawnmower, that's what I'm going to hear for the rest of my life. But man, I fucking love that scene.
I love that scene. At the beginning, when they're walking over and Bruce Dern's wife says, I'm doing a misjustice. What was her name? Bonnie. When Bonnie says, I'll make brownies. And then they walk out of Bruce Dern's house to cross the road. And he's holding them in the air, like above his head. Like just walking. Like
and then he drops them anyway.
Or something. I just got to keep them out of reach. Like what? Normal people would hold them in front of them with two hands. Not this dude.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a psycho. And that is the great... Again, it's like everything else in the film. Everything's exaggerated. But they just about find the limits where, again, it feels relatable. You can imagine finding a weirdo like that. It's like just the other week, there was a dude, like they've bought the house across me. It's like a really nice house across the road. But there's like a skylight at the top. And just out of the blue, one of the guys was doing Tai Chi topless on the roof. So I'm like sitting there in the living room. I suddenly look out the window and across the roof, there's just this dude standing on the roof topless doing Tai Chi in his 50s. I'm like, that's the kind of guy I want to live in my neighborhood. Like, he's the fucking weirdo, man. And it's just, well, I mean, I was going to say an exaggeration, but that's pretty weird. I mean, that feels like it fits directly into the burbs.
Yeah.
But again, it's just one of the reasons why it was like when you're younger, you've got more of a sense of adventure. So you're watching the Goonies and you're willing to believe that there could be a pirate ship. But like I said, this plays into that idea that, you know, of course you're not going to believe that, but you could believe this. So it's just like, it just keeps it on the limit. Like this could happen. This could be a thing. And it's only, like you said before, like the last 3 minutes when it really throws the fucking, you know, just says, well, balls to this. We're going to go psycho now. The Klopex are killers. They've killed a bajillion people. This film's insane.
Going from that last 3 minutes, I like the realness they were trying to do with it as well. Like, for lack of a better word, when they attacked the rubbish men, pulled all the rubbish out of the... and we'll get back to the rubbish men, see if you recognize them in a sec. But when they pulled them out and they chucked it all over the floor, as you go through the rest of the film, day, night, that rubbish doesn't move. It just gets... like more and more trodden in or driven over or anything. So that is a great sense of continuity. That's not being cleaned. That just keeps going and just keeps getting worse and just keeps blowing over. And it's people from the suburbs going, well, that's not my problem.
Yeah. It's like someone's going to sort this out. Yeah. This is America. Someone else will sort this out.
Did you notice who they were?
Well, yeah, it actually leads into the next. Well, one of them, I can't remember his name, but he's the guy from Gremlins, which is one of the links between Joe Dante, who directed this film, also directed Gremlins. And he's the drunk, isn't he? The guy, is he just a drunk in Gremlins? I can't remember what else he did in that film.
No, he was the actual neighbor, wasn't he?
Oh, he's the neighbor, yeah. But I think there was a scene in a bar when he's really drunk. That's all.
And they bring him home. Yeah, and the other garbage man, Robert Picardo, who was
Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
I wasn't a huge Star Trek. I was just going to say Star Trek, but he was also he was also in Gremlins 2.
Oh yeah, he was in Gremlins 2.
So he was the guy who, at the end of Gremlins 2, is getting sexually harassed by female Yoda,
and just lets it happen. He totally lets it happen.
Yeah,
he has sex with that transsexual, or at least I'm not sure if it's a transgender gremlin or it was cross-dressing gremlin.
It was female Yoda. It looked exactly like Yoda.
Either way, he was having sex with that gremlin. 100%. So, but yeah, like another, it's not such an obvious link to Gremlins, but one of my favorite scenes, one of the most memorable scenes in Gremlins is the story about Santa, her father, falling down the chimney and breaking his neck, and then not knowing where he is, and then noticing the smell, and then obviously he'd fallen and broken his neck, and that's what they were smelling, is her father like decaying behind the goddamn fireplace. It's super dark. And this film does a really similar thing, where Art, just out of the blue, tells the story about Skip, the ice cream man.
The fountain guy. Yeah,
soda fountain guy, sorry, who kills his whole family. And then they're like, oh, you know, they had this hot summer and they end up smelling the family and stuff. And it's just him just totally, or just because he can get away with it, th- throwing in a super, super dark story into an otherwise film which kind of walks the line. But you do have these moments when it inches into something a lot darker. You know?
That was good as well, because that felt like something that would happen to you as well, more when you were a kid, maybe not this age, or they were like in their early 30s probably in that film. Somebody is telling a story, like you're in a group and somebody's telling a story to somebody else, mm-hmm. and you start to fixate on that story. And then all of a sudden, oh, yeah, I remember that as well. You may not have remembered that. You may not have heard it before. But all of a sudden, you're like, oh, you know what? Yeah, that did happen when I was a kid. I remember that as well.
Yeah, and then that's almost Ray's exact reaction. Like, he's almost convincing you into himself.
It. Like, do you know what I mean? Totally. And it makes you part of it then. And then it becomes believable for others. And I kind of like the way they did that. But then they were doing that just to turn around then and scream at Ray and just scare the living shit out of him.
Yeah, which again just like plays into this idea that it's a total boys club. It's like, you know, they have this like moment, and it reminds me of like some of the shit we'll say. It's like if me and the guys are playing Warzone, for instance, and someone says they've got to go because they've got to have dinner or something stupid, like even though we don't mean it and it's super misogynistic, like the first things we'll say are like, is like they say this, like, oh, dude, like Ray's siding with the chicks. He's totally pussy whipped. Yeah. His balls are in his wife's purse. Yeah. It's like, again, plays into this idea that these are all just big kids.
Although I loved when they were saying about going to ask your wife to get your balls back or whatever, and he pulled his hands up his trousers.
Like, and I didn't mean it literally.
Like he's going to pull them out.
All right. Well, before we get into the usual subjects, what do we usually call them?
I do have one more thing to mention before we move on.
Yeah, me too. The nightmare scene. I love the nightmare scene. Like, again, this film like walks the line, but they have that nightmare scene so we can really go for it.
Yeah.
And while I love everything about it, and I love the fact before he actually falls asleep, this is 1989 TV, and he's flicking through channels, and it's like The Exorcist, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's just horror on every single channel. The only one I don't know.
What TV are you watching?
Yeah, but what's the first movie? Like when he turns on the TV, it's like it looks like a sacrifice, like a new girl's being sacrificed. And I don't know what that film is. Do you have any idea?
I don't, but I do remember reading about it. So give me a sec. Keep talking. And I'll go back.
No worries. Well, as I said, I mean, the fact that it has these nods then to The Exorcist and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and then goes straight into his actual nightmare, and the use of music. Of the score in that scene in particular, and we will get to the soundtrack in a bit, but Jerry Goldsmith's score throughout this film is absolutely exceptional. The way it goes from like light-hearted, happy, fun, loving suburbia to like horror movie score, and often it'll cut in between the two. You know, it's like it'll be playful 1 second, it'll be almost horrific. It's old-fashioned horror, it's traditional horror. That score has got a bit of everything. And in terms of like laying the foundations for the tone of the film, again, it starts with that opening sequence when the camera zooms in. The music's a massive part of it. And what it reminds me of, you mentioned it earlier, is Beetlejuice. You think of how much the mood of that film, all you're seeing is a miniature set, but because of I think Danny Elfman did the score for Beetlejuice, you're getting the tone for the movie straight out the gate before you see anything, before you hear anyone talk. And they do the same thing with this. I think you know, and this is a guy, what's his name, Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah,
he's more famous for horror movie scores. This is the guy who did The Omen, Poltergeist, Aliens, and it's almost like they said, listen, we want that kind of that history, that classical, you know, link to horror movies, but we want this to be fun. And again, he absolutely nails it. And I'm not sure if everybody is clear on what kind of film they're making. Supposedly Tom Hanks, when he saw it, was he thought he was in a more like a darker film. He thought it was going to be a scarier movie, and it was only when he watched it afterwards that he's like, man, this is quite a bit of slapstick. And it's one of the underrated aspects of this film, is just because physical comedy is so hard to get right. And some of the physical comedy in this film is absolutely brilliant. And I mean, people forget Tom Hanks, at this point, he was still largely a comedic actor. Like when I grew up, he wasn't a dramatic actor. Like, yeah, he had moments, but he was the guy from Splash. He was the guy from Big. He was the guy from The Burbs.
This Bachelor guy's Party, yeah.
Dragnet. That's a flat out comedy. Bachelor Party, yeah. And like the moment when obviously when they go and ring the doorbell, the bees come out, Bruce Dern runs out with the hose, he trips up, then they jump down and he's hosing him down because of the bees. That's classic slapstick. One of my favorite moments of physical comedy is right at the end, and it's super subtle. It's, you know, when the house is blown up and Tanks comes out, and he's he looks completely fucked up, like his eyes all swollen, his clothes are all torn off, and the way he somehow slides down the steps without falling, it's just this perfect moment of physical comedy where he doesn't lift his feet, he just somehow drops almost like a toy down three steps. Oh, it's so good. Tom Hanks is he's such a great actor. I mean, me saying that sounds ridiculous. Of course, everyone knows that. But I think his comedic chops are outstanding.
Right, I found the films.
Did you find out what you're looking for? Because I feel like
I told you to keep talking. Race with the Devil was...
Yeah, I can't go. If somebody tells me to keep talking, I'll keep fucking talking.
Race with the Devil was the first one. I've never heard of Race with the Devil, so... The Exorcist, yes, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Or me. It's just odd that, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. It's just strange that you get like two such iconic movies, but then that first one, I'm like, I thought maybe it was a nod to something, but God knows. All that build up for a film neither of us have ever heard of. So, yeah, my apologies. I should have just kept my mouth shut.
No, just keep
going. But yeah, sorry, you wanted to bring something up before we...
So I only had two things, not as in-depth as that, but I did love the last two things that I highlighted on. The first one was Pizza Dude being used a lot. Like he was, like Corey Feldman was prepping for his role in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Absolutely. He says pizza a lot. The pizza dude's coming.
And when he finally comes, he goes, pizza dude. And it just, awesome. It takes you back too. Because he was Donatello in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, wasn't he? So that was...
Yeah.
I liked
it's such a 90s thing to get super excited about pizza.
I do like that pre-nod. To a film he hadn't created yet. But I loved it when they were in the ambulance. And then... Everything, that's when it all took the dark turn. Like, he's in the ambulance and he's going, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Klopek. And he's like, where's my skull? And he pulls out this needle and then Hans drives off the van. And he's dressed...
The reanimator-style needle.
He's dressed like Hans Christian Andersen or Pinocchio. Like, Hans is dressed as.
Pinocchio. I love Hans.
When the stretcher flies out of the back, after they crash into Art House... And I thought that was a bit of justice. The way Art acted throughout this film, his house needed to get destroyed. So that's why I like this ending. But when it flies out, that bloody stretcher, and it just takes an immediate right turn. Like it comes out, and it just takes the sharpest of right turns you've ever seen. And then it goes straight towards them all. I just thought, I don't know why I fixated on that.
Yeah.
But I just laughed my ass off.
It's a strange one for sure. And the fact that it hits the back of the car, it makes the boot pop up. And you have Corey Feldman's character who just decides to pull off the blanket to reveal all the human skulls. And he just immediately, Klopek just gives up. He's like, well, yeah, I did kill a lot of people.
You can explain any, like, you'd at least try and go, they're for a museum or, do you know what I mean? But I've murdered a lot of people.
I mean, he's the great thing in this film because, of course, you know, when you're first introduced to the family and it's Hans and he's so weird. And what's the other guy's name?
He was just uncle something, wasn't he?
Rube. Yeah, Brewster keeps calling him Rube. Yeah. Hey, Rube. What you got in the cellar, Rube? But it's when, like, of course, they're almost like caricatures, but it's when Henry Gibson's character, my brother, the doctor, shows up. And he seems so polite, but you can see something's not right there. You can see, like, even his little scene when he, like, unscrews the cap, sugar substitute. He's just like, dude, this guy has killed everyone. He's so fucking weird.
I loved he said, I thought the candles would be a little bit more romantic. And then he moves... He moves out of frame of the camera and you just see what is essentially like a satanic ritual candle.
Yeah.
They're the kind of candles that you...
There's like 27 candles all squeezed together. I'd never noticed it before. It's brilliant. But I mean, you mentioned earlier about the facts of this film. There's only, as you say, I've got a few here. You've already mentioned the Universal lot where Desperate Housewives was shot. Funny enough, the one house you don't see that often is Corey Feldman's house. Because it was the house from the Munsters, and they thought it was so iconic at the time, because the Munsters were still really popular, that they couldn't have it in the film because it would be distracting. They'd be like, wait, that's the house from the Munsters. So the Munsters' house is on there. The other fact I got is, again, we've mentioned Joe Dante directed Gremlins. There's a scene when, at the start, when he's having breakfast, and you can see Gremlin cereal on the side, which is awesome. It's really prominent with Gizmo on the front. Down in the basement of the Klopex house, there's a sled with Rosebud on it, which is a very unsubtle nod to Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Never noticed that before. And supposedly, the dog, Queenie, was actually the same dog as Buffalo Bill's dog from Silence of the Lambs, which I had no idea. I thought it was pretty cool. And the last one I've got, of all people, did you know who got banned from set? From the set of this film?
I know this one.
Go for it, dude.
Yeah, it was Michael Jackson's monkey Bubbles.
Yeah, because he was just smearing shit on the trailers and stuff.
Because he wasn't allowed on set, so he had to stay in Corey Feldman's trailer. And every time he went in, there was just, as they put it, feces thrown around.
It's a weird one now, isn't it? Because you don't know how to feel about it, because there's all these stories about Michael Jackson, and you hear Michael Jackson showing up on set, you're like, oh God, I hope this was all about, but I'm still one of these people because I grew up with Michael Jackson, and it was such a big part of my musical upbringing that I really want to believe that he didn't do it.
I question.
He did touch some children, but it's Michael Jackson.
I question Michael Jackson going, I want to visit Corey, but I can't, so I'm going to send my driver to take my monkey to the set.
Yeah, yeah. Like, just so he remembers me.
That whole thought process is ridiculous. It's fantastic, but it's ridiculous.
Strange thought process and Michael Jackson kind of come hand in hand, I think.
Yeah. So I didn't have many. Like I said, you've covered a lot of the ones I had, but there was one that was interesting. Apparently, they all got on so well that Tom Hanks bought everyone glasses, like sunglasses, at the end, and he wrote handwritten notes.
Okay.
To everyone. And I don't know how true this is, but we were talking about her as well. Bruce Dern's wife, Bonnie, played by Wendy Shaw. She had glasses and a note as well. And the note from Tom Hanks just read, I don't know what you do on this film.
I don't think Tom Hanks knew what was going on.
So he didn't understand what her role in this film was, like why she was there.
That is amazing. I love that about films, that sometimes people, like, they make these films and it's like they're in certain scenes and stuff like that, but then they come out of it and they're just like, I don't know what kind of film this is. And again, it's like you think how different this film could be if, say, the score was different. So, you know, the importance of score, a bit of editing, even, you know, we talked about the alternate ending where it made, instead of feeling like a kind of lighthearted horror comedy, suddenly it made the whole film feel like more of a satire. So, you know, this idea that you make a film and you're like, I'm not really sure what kind of film I'm in. And it suits the character, of course, that he's more grounded. But he and Carrie Fisher are these really grounded, believable characters for the most part. And then everyone else is a caricature around them. And it works because they're the beating heart of the film. But you wonder sometimes, is it because largely he thought he was in a different film? I mean, it fucking could be.
You never know. I mean, the script might have been doctored for him in any way, shape, or form. But like you said, it does feel like he feels like he's acting in what's quintessentially going to be a horror film, and it ends up just being a slapstick comedy of errors film. Like, just And when I went back to, like, what was the point in this film? Like, because there isn't really much of, like, it's a random plot in regards to, it's literally just a week in the life of bored people.
Yeah, it really is. It's just,
in the end, exactly, something actually happens, and they get lucky with the fact that, oh yeah, we are living next door to murderers. But it could have...
they get lucky.
I blew up my well-meaning neighbor's house because I was bored.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like you say, if you take away those last few minutes and you end this slightly earlier, it is exactly what you say. It's like, oh, well, I take the week off. We all think that our foreign neighbors are potentially murderers. We find out they're not. The end. You know, it's just, you know, it really is that. But obviously, they kind of up the stakes towards the end. But I love the fact that it's quite light on plot. It's very character-driven. It's very relatable. Again, it's one of those films, it's all about the charm. It's all about the characters. It's all about the tone, the mood, everything about it. And they're the things I love. And that's why it's one of those films where I could just jump in 20, 30 minutes in and I could have it on in the background. It's the kind of movie where, you know, like some places, you go to like a pub or a bar and they just have a movie kind of playing on in the background the whole time. And one of the classic films you often see is something like The Big Lebowski, which again is not a similar film, but in terms of like the plot's almost a bit ridiculous. It's almost not important. That film's more about tone, about place, about characters. And this is the same. You could just have it on in the background playing 24/7, and I'd be quite happy. Just the score every so often just kind of plopping into my head.
And don't get me wrong. Like I said, I went into this, and I didn't watch it as much as a kid as I thought, as other mm-hmm. films. And I don't understand why they're doing what they're doing for this film. But that doesn't mean I won't go back and watch it again. Mm-hmm. Or I didn't, like I said, tape it as a kid and watch it over and over. Watch it again. Well, every time it was on TV and I'd find it on TV, like looking for the TV guide, I'd set the recorder and I'd tape it. Then I'd tape over it for something else. That's what you did as a kid.
Yeah.
But But it wasn't one of those ones where I know, like, we had a comment from somebody who asked this question who said that he's always watching this film. And I can see why. It is a film, like you say, you can go in from the beginning, you can go in halfway through, and you can just finish this film. And I do understand that. And you've already given the rating for this film, and I'd probably put it as a 3.5 out of 5 for it. But it's not a terrible film.
Funny enough, I actually had that written down. You say 3.5, because I was like, it's the perfect 4 out of 5. But if I was doing a 10-point ranking, it's the perfect 7 out of 10. So it fits in with exactly what you said there.
Yeah, it's just, it is a film that you could watch again, but it's a throwaway film as well in regards to...
Yeah.
There's nothing happening. Right up until the last 3 minutes, there are no stakes for anyone. There's no... You know what I mean? It's literally...
Nothing's important. And that is...
It's a week in the life, as I've already said, of bored 30-somethings.
Yeah, it's just a commentary on suburbia. Like, you go there, and it's like, you know, you're living this pleasant, uneventful, largely unthreatening life.
Yeah.
And that's the point. It's like they're trying to find... So obviously, again, we come back to the idea that there is something there eventually. But this could have just as easily worked where they go through, they're trying to find something exciting. They're trying to find, you know, they want there to be something, but there's not. You know, it's like, oh, they could be murderers. But they're not. They're trying to find something out of the ordinary in their completely routine suburban life. And it played, like I said, that whole satirical edge, it's a bit, you know, it's dealt with more directly in the alternate ending. But in this film, like everything else, like the horror, it's all under the surface. It's all subtle. You can pick it up if you want to. It doesn't really matter. Just enjoy yourself. It just let the film wash over you, essentially. Yeah. And that's what it does to me. Like you say, this film isn't important at all. But it's just nice. It's charming. It's nice. It's totally rewatchable. And it's one of the, I couldn't tell you why my friends and I all took to this film so much. I think it's like you said, when we were younger, and especially back in the early 90s, when realistically we would have watched this when we were quite young, is that if somebody rented it and enjoyed it, you know, we had a relatively limited number of films we could watch. Yeah. So if somebody took to it, then a lot of your friends end up watching it. Like, all the time I'd have friends come over my house to watch movies, you know? And it was like my house was the house where everyone came to watch movies because my mum and dad let us watch 18 movies. So everyone would come around, because even if they weren't allowed, my mum and dad never asked any questions. So it was like, listen, my son's watching Running Man, Commando, Terminator. You can watch it as well because you're sitting next to him. So, and I know this isn't a violent film, but it's more to... lean into the point that because we like The Burbs, it meant a lot of my friends like The Burbs. And I'm not saying it's necessarily on us, we're the reason, but it was, you know, it could have been the other way around. But certain films back then, it was like everybody had seen The Burbs loads, everyone had seen Friday loads, just these random films. Just like, why have all my friends all seen Running Man? Running Man's not a classic, but everyone's fucking seen it.
I think we're actually into legacy now, the legacy section as we're going on. But I agree with you wholeheartedly with that, because if you've watched the film, that is the one thing you're talking about the next day in school. It just snowballs out of there and it just keeps going. Like you said, we all watched Running Man or random films like Commando, Running Man, films that you shouldn't
Robot
be watching
jocks.
At that age. Sorry?
Yeah. Robot Jocks.
Oh my God. Yeah. If anyone has actually heard of Robot Jocks besides me and Liam, please let us know.
I did bring it up to one of my friends on Facebook, and they're like, I've never even heard of Robot Jocks, but I think they were intrigued by the trailer. They're like, is it as bad as it looks? I'm like, yeah, it's pretty fucking bad. Honestly, I think, let's see now, if we get to episode 100 has to be Robot Jocks. We've mentioned it like every other episode. So eventually, if we manage to get to 100 episodes, we'll do Robot Jocks for sure.
We'll have to. The best way to settle to settle global disputes is to just have giant fighting robots in an arena. Why not?
100%. It's the only way to do it. But like you say, like coming back to the whole legacy thing, it's weird because this film, obviously, it was a humble hit at the time. It actually got totally savaged by critics when it came out.
Yeah, they hated it.
And I think it comes down to the fact that people hated it. Well, I just don't think people knew what they were dealing with. Obviously, the opinion has changed. I think it's very much a cult classic now. Opinion is warm to it. But I think at the time, people were like, what is this film? It, you know, very much what you said. Like, if you didn't warm to the tone stuff, you can watch it and be like, this film's totally fucking pointless. What's going on? But I think it's just over time, more and more people have seen it. The fact that it is so timeless. And speaking of legacy, one of the things we always ask is, you know, would you want this remade? No. Does it need a sequel? No. Do you want a TV show? No. Just watch The Burbs. It's just its own little perfect slice of cinema.
Because, yeah, it doesn't have a date.
There's nothing quite like it. Nothing.
No. It doesn't have a date to it. So it doesn't need to be reimagined, revisited, re-anything. Just leave it alone and watch this film.
Just watch this.
You're saying about...
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So yeah, honestly, I think it feels utterly timeless. I really do.
The budget was 18 million. The box office was 49.1. So it made a bit of money for 80 standards. That's not too
bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially considering the reviews were so bad.
Yeah. But I agree with you.
I don't think anyone at the time. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I don't think anyone at the time, you know, when it was released, you had the reviews. It was a humble hit. I don't think it's the kind of film they assumed that would be so. And I think it is beloved, not necessarily by everyone, but by those who have watched it and have an attachment to it. I think those who like this film often love it in the same way that I do. I think a lot of people have the same relationship with The Burbs that I do. Certainly, I think a lot of my friends do. Like when we put up the post for this on Facebook, so much of the chat was super positive. Like, excuse me, the first thing people said was, oh, I fucking love that film. I love that film. And I think it just connects with a lot of people in a strange way.
You will get more love than hate for this film. And it's very hard to hate. Don't get me wrong. I said, what's the point in this film? But I've never once turned around and said that I didn't like this film. This film is charming. Yeah. It is interesting to watch. It's a film I will watch again. But again, there is just no point in this film.
that is the thing. And I wonder as well, because I love it. You know, you at least enjoy it. I know a lot of my friends certainly love it. One of the people I know doesn't like it, and doesn't hate it, but is my wife. And I wonder if it's the same reason that, as say, like if you take Curb Your Enthusiasm, I've spoken to so many women and it comes up in conversations like Curb Your Enthusiasm and all the guys are like, oh, I love Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it'll often be the women who say, I fucking hate that show. I don't see the point of it. And this isn't as extreme as Curb Your Enthusiasm, but so much of The Burbs is about male neurosis. It's about guys being assholes, about being, you know, weird male shit. So much of the film is driven by that. In the same way, obviously, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the whole show is male neurosis. And I think, you know, women watch it and go like, these guys are just assholes. Because do you know what? We are assholes. Most women, I think they immediately watch it and go, I'm with Carol. You're all being a bunch of dicks. Ray's a dick. His friends are bellends. There's nobody likable here. Whereas we're like, oh yeah, Ray reminds me of me. Art reminds me of my best friend. You know, it's just, I think, I'd love it if people correct me, but I think of it as a dude film, like a really male centric movie.
Yeah, well, it was the first time my wife watched it last night. And
what did she think out of interest?
It's really hard to put into words that are a bit kinder than what she said, but she liked the story of it and she thought it was quite funny in places, but with the same as what you said then about what your wife said. The guys are just being dicks.
Yeah.
Guys are just totally being, and they've led themselves down this path that is literally any other time would get them arrested.
Oh, 100%. Like, and again, everything's walking the line. They don't quite do enough maybe to get arrested. Arguably,
they blew up a house.
At the end, though, that's when the police show up. Like, the police are there when it really gets out of hand. But the whole film, it borders on, sure, you know, trespassing and stuff like that. But it's more like hijinks and childish games, just at a slightly more adult level. But, you know, even the Clopex, they never have quite enough on the Clopex to call the police. They never do quite enough or get caught doing anything when the Clopex are called the police. So the whole time is just light-hearted shenanigans until, of course, you find out, yeah, the house blows up, they're murderers, yeah, yada, yada, yada. But, oh, God, I love this film. All right, so the last, I mean, we've already mentioned soundtrack. So this film doesn't need a late 80s, early 90s cracker-friendly rap song. I don't think it needs that. We've already mentioned the fact that the Jerry Goldsmith score is fantastic, the fact that it can go between horror and comedy. Yeah. I love Queenie's song, where Queenie's running across the lawn to crap on Bruce Stern's lawn, and it's like, woof, 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 woof. And it reminds me of my wife and I, because we're cat lunatics, singing songs but replacing the lyrics with just meow, which is just fucking sad as hell. But I've done it a lot, and that's what that reminded me of. I wish I hadn't admitted that now.
And we're friends. Yes,
I know. Okay, this might be the last episode of this podcast, in fairness. So we'll jump straight to the last... why can't I get the word out? It's not subject. Category. Jesus category. Fucking Christ. So video game. There was no video game for the Birds, unsurprisingly. One of the questions we have, could Naughty Dog make a... No, the Naughty Dog are not making a Birds game. The only thing I could think of which would work is if there was a Birds spin-off of The Sims. I think that would totally work.
Okay, because I found it really hard to what game I would like this to be. I didn't even think of The Sims. That's a good shout. I can't think, because like I said, because
that's the only thing I can think
there
of.
There's nothing to work towards.
No, there's not.
There's no goal for the game. There's no, like, you can't. The best I could do, like, this game, if you were putting this film into a game, it would be the random Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure game. Where all they're doing is traveling along a path. They're not allowed to go on the grass or they'll die, and they got to go on the path. So that's the only thing I could think of. Like, you've got to travel along Mayfield Place to get to the house, and you've got to dodge a dick paperboy, or you've got to dodge Queenie's shit that she's dropping her along the floor. That's the only thing I could think of that it would feel like. But it'd have to be, again, a top-down, old-school 16 or 8-bit NES game.
Well, that is the thing, because there's not enough plot, essentially, or, you know, aim, I suppose, for lack of a better word. That's why I think, rather than it being a Burbs game, I think when I think of this film, I think of mood, I think of visuals, I think of tone, is that you essentially have DLC, Burbs DLC for existing games. So a perfect example is what we've already mentioned. You could have the Paperboy, a Paperboy level where, I mean, it's basically already that game, but you could have him cycling down Mayfield Place.
Yeah.
And you've got all the houses and the characters. And the same with The Sims. Like, you don't need... You essentially make the plot. So instead of there being a plot, you're just walking around Mayfield Place in this Sims-esque universe. It's got the houses. It's got the characters again. So, yeah, I think it's more of a DLC thing rather than an actual game itself. So I'm going to say Paperboy DLC or The Sims. Sims the Burbs, which I actually think would be amazing. But we'll see. But yeah, so I think that's pretty much it. So, like you said, the ratings, I've already given mine 4 stars. You were three and a half?
3.5 for me, yeah.
3.5. Does it hold up better than most films? Like, this film, I mean, we've said it a million times already, absolutely timeless. If you haven't seen this film before, I don't think, other than seeing the fact that Tom Hanks is young, there's very little to give away that this is a late 80s film. No. It's as good today as it ever was. And if you're asking me whether, if you've never seen it before, should you watch it? 100%, because it's such an easy watch. I think I'd be genuinely surprised if anyone hated this film.
Because there are no stakes, because there is no, as I keep going back to it, there is no plot line. There's no time. There's no date. There's no anything that you could date this film. You could go back to this film. You could go back at any point and watch this film. So absolutely, if you've never watched this film, go back and watch it.
No, it's on Amazon Prime.
Go and watch it. It's currently on Amazon Prime. So
that's a great film. As I said, four stars, but the best kind of 4-star movie. The best 4-star movie out there. So yeah, that's it for the Burbs this week. You know, as always, we'll ask you to follow us on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter at HeyYouGuys80s. Is that correct?
And we're also, if you fancy dropping us a review or any recommendations, or just to have a quick chat on email, feel free to email us on heyyouguys80s@gmail.com.
Okay, yeah. So without further ado, the only thing left is the movie for next week. So your choice, sir. What are you going to go with?
So I had in my head what I was going to go with for the week. Then I changed it before we went on to this call. Mm-hmm. But as we've gone through this call, I've changed it again.
Oh my god! Oh, so we're not going to mention what you thought you were going to pick because we'll get to those eventually.
That is still going to be on there, but I've literally mentioned it again. And I don't know. It was something that you said, and I can't really pinpoint what was said during that made me think I want to watch this film next. And it's not even a direct correlation. Like, you can't go from The Burbs to what I'm going to pick.
But oh, well, now I'm excited. What is it, man?
Something you said made me go there. It's Big Trouble in Little China.
Awesome. Awesome. That's a great, great choice. I think people are going to be excited to have a chat about that.
I need some Pork Chop Express in my life, as it were.
I mean, funny enough, my friends, my brother and I, we all had a bit of a moment with Big Trouble in Little China not too long ago. Obviously, I won't go into all the details now, but I got my wife to watch it. She had never seen it before. Mixed reviews, should we say? And even myself going back to, let's just say I'm going to have a lot to say about this movie. So I think that's another great shout.
Yours was The Burbs. Like you said, you watched The Burbs. I think that might be why, because Big Trouble in Little China was mine.
Awesome.
And I said, you'll have a lot to say. I'll have a lot to say. I cannot wait to rewatch this again. This is the film that I probably watched at least once a month for about 5 years. As a kid.
Well, all I'll say is don't worry about lack of plot in this one because there's fucking tons of it. So yeah, I am genuinely, this has come as a surprise to me, this last minute change of heart. So I am legit looking forward to Big Trouble in Little China. So yeah, if you can join us, we usually record Sunday, Monday. We try and get the podcast up Tuesday morning. So yeah, coming soon, Big Trouble in Little China. But dude, this has always been super fun.
Yeah,
this
has
been
a great time.
Guys Podcast. This has been The Burbs. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank you. Are you good?